Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Along with the costs you expect with a baby, from diapers to childcare, add in medical debt. For many families, that can bring a lot of stress and in some cases make them reconsider having more children. The Boy Scouts of America is changing to a gender-neutral name. A scouting leader talks to us about the future of the organization. We'll bring you a series on students with intellectual disabilities and what services are available to them as they transition to adult life. We'll visit with two retiring teachers and hear how things have changed during the 3 decades they've spent in the classroom and what they'll miss the most. And we'll get an update on the company formerly known as Schwann's. For decades, its drivers delivered food items, but things are changing. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Smoky air blowing in from Canadian wildfires plagued parts of Illinois last summer. By year's end, Chicago had experienced some of the worst air quality in the nation. A report from the Swiss company IQ Air found Chicago was the second most polluted major city in the U.S. in 2023. Only Columbus, Ohio was higher. Two experts from the Regional Office of the Environmental Protection Agency, Katie Siegel, an air toxic and assessments branch manager, and Michael Comfier, an air monitoring and analysis section supervisor, talk with Mel Ballara about what can be expected this summer.
Katie, I want to start with you. What is the outlook for this summer? Are the conditions right for a repeat of last year's smoky air that we saw around here?
Thank you. That's a great question. And while we don't have a crystal ball, you know, I will say that conditions are ripe for another active wildfire season this summer. This is due to the ongoing impacts of climate change. You know, it was a warm winter with less snowpack, and, you know, all these factors contribute to increased fires.
Michael, that report that I mentioned that ranked Chicago so high on the list of polluted cities, it was actually looking at something called PM 2.5. A lot of us don't know what that is, but can you explain what it is and how it can affect people?
Absolutely, Melba. PM 2.5 is one of the air pollutants that EPA is most focused on right now. It's made up of small particles that are in the air, and they can be emitted from a number of sources, including wildfires. So PM 2.5 is much smaller than even the width of a human hair. And one of the reasons we're concerned about it is that it can travel deep into the lungs and contribute to health impacts. So those with respiratory and lung diseases are especially impacted by PM 2.5. And we're very focused on reducing the emissions of PM 2.5 so that people's health is improved.
And Michael, this year the EPA announced it was lowering the amount of exposure to PM 2.5. It's going to allow from 12 micrograms per cubic meter to 9 micrograms. Does wildfire smoke make it hard to hit that new standard?
You are correct. EPA did strengthen the air quality standard this year. This will provide increased public health protection and is consistent with the available science that relates human health to air pollution. The Clean Air Act and EPA's exceptional event rule does provide a framework for us to address air quality data that's impacted by wildfire smoke. So we work with our states to identify times in which our air quality is impacted by wildfire smoke, and we take that into account when determining whether and when areas are violating or are attaining our air quality standards.
And Katie, I want to bring you back in here. If we see more poor air quality days in Chicago this summer, what's your advice for people to stay healthy?
I think the biggest thing is to plan ahead. EPA has many great resources and tools out there. I'd encourage everyone to download the Air Now app, and you can visit airnow.gov. And what that allows us to do is have real-time information about air quality. And you can see what it's projected to be over the next few days, and you can plan ahead.
And before I let both of you go, a lot of times climate change and air pollution feels like something none of us can do anything about. Is there anything that we can do as individuals?
I think there are a lot of things we can do as individuals. It can be as simple as thinking about your diet. It can be looking at your home. Is it as energy efficient as it could be? I think there are things, you know, big and small that we can all do to lower our carbon footprint.
Katie Siegel and Michael Comfier from the regional office of the EPA in Chicago, and they spoke with Melba Lara. Two groups are counting how many heavy trucks pass through communities of color in Chicago. The data paints a picture of the environmental footprint of tailpipe pollution in those neighborhoods. A recent study shows that transitioning to electric trucks can save lives and money. Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco reports.
Paulina Oaka stands at the corner of Pulaski and 41st Street in the southwest side of Chicago. All around us, a dullish tint clouds the air. It's from tailpipe exhaust.
I'm seeing a sea of trucks. I don't know about you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 just off the top of my field of vision, and more coming and going.
Baca is a project coordinator at the Center for Neighborhood Technology, a local group that researches sustainable communities. Her organization just co-published a study with the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization that found that this is one of the city's busiest intersections for truck traffic.
Yeah, and these are mostly heavy-duty vehicles.
The study found about 430 trucks pass through this spot in just 1 hour. Jose Miguel Acosta Cordova is here too. He's a transportation justice program manager at the Little Village Group. He says if you count up all the trucks that drive through this part, the majority Latino neighborhood, throughout a single day, it's way more.
At this particular intersection, we had over 5,000 medium and heavy-duty vehicles that were counted.
The groups knew that communities near the city's industrial corridors experienced heavy truck traffic, think semis and buses. But they wanted numbers, so they started counting. Using sensors installed in 35 intersections, they counted how many trucks moved through these spots throughout a 24-hour window. The results didn't surprise Acosta Cordova.
We are the largest freight hub, but there's certain areas in the city and in the region where it's more concentrated than others, right? Where you see that truck traffic daily and then all the issues that come with it.
More than $1 trillion in goods move through the Chicago region by way of truck, train, ship, and plane every year. It's the largest freight hub in all North America. But being at the center of the freight economy comes with a heavy price. Brian Urbacheski with the Respiratory Health Association says exposure to tailpipe pollution from diesel can mean serious medical complications.
These particles, you know, get into your body through your lungs, can cause breathing problems, but they can cause a host of other things because they're circulating to every major organ in your body.
A recent study from Northwestern University researchers found that transitioning to electric trucks could have huge health benefits for communities plagued by poor air quality.
We found that the majority of the health benefits from those reductions in pollution occur in EJ communities or communities of color or disadvantaged communities in Chicago.
That's Daniel Horton. He teaches earth sciences at Northwestern. His study also found that more than 1,000 lives could be saved annually if the Chicago region electrified about 30% of all light and heavy-duty vehicles. Back at Pulaski and 41st, Jose Miguel Acosta Cordova says the health and trucking data lead to an obvious solution.
The biggest thing we want to see out of this is and continue to see more data collection, but also eventually a full transition to zero emission trucks.
He hopes this new truck count is enough to convince Illinois lawmakers to do something about the air pollution choking communities in Chicago's south and west sides. I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco.
The Boy Scouts of America will soon adopt a gender-neutral name. That move to rebrand as Scouting America comes 5 years after the program started to admit girls as Cub Scouts. The change also comes amid a tumultuous time for the Scouts. The program nationally has faced financial problems tied to a sex abuse scandal and a big drop in membership that followed the pandemic. Ben Blumenberg is CEO of the WD Boyce Council of the Boy Scouts of America. The council represents 4,000 scouts in 14 central Illinois counties. He told Eric Stock the scouts are on the rebound, and the new name is another sign of inclusion for the 114-year-old organization.
The name change is really designed to help remind families, moms, dads, kids, that the scouting program is for all kids. The historic name Boy Scouts of America, for some of our members, has meant boys only. But we've had girls in our programs, in particular the exploring program, since as early as the 1960s.
And girls were brought into the Boy Scouts on a much greater level 5 years ago. What impact has that had?
We heard from families, especially families today that have both mom and dad working or single parent families, that they believe scouting was important for their kids, but trying to take a daughter one direction and a son another direction was just too difficult. So that's what precipitated us into allowing girls to join the Cub Scout program. Cub Scouts is really a family-based program, so everyone in the family is invited to participate there. And when we did that, we knew that eventually girls in the Cub Scout program would need a place to go if they wanted to stay involved with our programs. And so we began to allow girls to join the Boy Scout program, which we now call Scouts BSA, and provide for them a path to earn the Eagle Scout Award.
What impact has that had nationally and with the WD Boys Council in terms of the number of scouts that you've had?
So currently about 14% of our total membership is female. We see that consistently growing. We expect it will come close to doubling this year because girls are getting involved at a really strong rate. We see there are a lot of girls that may have sat on the sidelines while an older brother participated in Scouts BSA or in Cub Scouts, but were really interested in the types of programs that we have to offer. And so now that they have that opportunity, they're joining in droves.
Now, when you say doubled, doubled from what to what?
We right now we have about 382 girls involved in our Scouts BSA and Cub Scout programs. On an average fall, we recruit about 150 new girls. And so we're really expecting that this fall we're going to have somewhere between 250 and 300 girls join throughout the council.
Because of the name change?
I think partly because of the name change, but also because they see the fun and exciting things that their friends are doing. Families realize that they can participate in the programs of Scouting America together as a family.
Those programs have been in effect for a number of years. Why the dramatic leap from this year to next, though?
So I think a couple of reasons. I think number one, the general public starting to become more aware that girls can join the programs of the Boy Scouts of America, now Scouting America. And then the girls that are already involved tend to be bringing friends at a really exciting rate. Girls are incredibly social. And, I have a daughter, a 12-year-old daughter that's involved in our Scouts BSA program. She's recruited three of her friends as well, just because they want to do things together.
What impact has this had in membership among boys in the last 5 years?
You know, it's interesting. Our membership with boys has stayed relatively the same. We don't see girls necessarily impacting that on a positive or a negative aspect, but we do see some families that have a boy and a girl that wouldn't previously had considered Cub Scouts for their son, but now that both their son and daughter can be involved in the Cub Scout program, they're joining. So, you know, we've had boys that didn't consider us before that now do because it's now open to the whole family.
And what has this done to membership numbers overall in the last 5 years?
So the WD Boys Council membership numbers are growing steady for the last 3 years. COVID really did a number on us. When schools closed down, schools are our primary entry point for kids to learn about scouting. And so effectively, we lost 2 years of recruitment, and we're watching those 2 years work their way through our program.
So where are you at now in 2024 compared to pre-COVID?
Pre-COVID, we're probably, I don't know, we're probably down 25% pre-COVID. If you think about the Cub Scout program is a five-year program, we would typically recruit in a given year 30% of the membership. So we missed 2 years of recruitment for a lot of our Cub Scout packs. So generally a Cub Scout pack serves one elementary school. For a lot of our Cub Scout packs that missed 2 years, they shrunk to the size that they weren't sustainable and they just closed their doors. So not only did we lose 2 years of membership, we also lost a whole pack because they didn't bring in new Cub Scouts or new leaders. So in a lot of communities, we're starting packs from scratch so that we can rebuild.
As we continue with Ben Blumenberg with the WD Boys Council of Boy Scouts of America in Central Illinois, looking nationally, the Boy Scouts nationally have had some financial problems. It had gone through bankruptcy as it is compensating about 80,000 men who say they had been sexually abused in scouting. Do you feel scouts are still dealing with an image problem from that?
You know, maybe there's a little bit of an image problem. I can tell you that anybody that was ever abused as a part of our program, we're absolutely heartbroken by that, right? The fact that bad people take advantage of any youth program to hurt kids is absolutely shameful. I think the important thing to realize, though, is that those cases were well in the past, well before the Boy Scouts of America, who really are leaders in keeping kids safe, instituted our current youth protection policies. And while any case of abuse is too many, they're basically non-existent currently in the Boy Scouts of America.
And going back to the name, the change that Boy Scouts plan to take effect next year, there's been some pushback in conservative media. They say the Scouts have gone woke by going to a gender-neutral name. What do you make of that? And are you concerned that some families may stop sending their boys to become Scouts?
That's a good question. So, you know, I think any institution, especially an organization that's been around for 115 years, that makes any sort of change is going to be criticized by one portion of society or another. I'm less concerned with that, right? My goal is to make sure that kids today have a great scouting program and have all the opportunities they need to be successful. And so I'm interested in moving forward to serve kids and families now. You know, I was a Boy Scout growing up, and I'll always refer to that, to being a Boy Scout growing up. But it's not about the program that I had when I was a kid. It's about what we can do for today's kids and today's families.
That's Ben Blumenberg with the WD Boys Council of the Boy Scouts of America. The organization is changing its name to a gender-neutral Scouting America. Just ahead, the cost of having a baby. This is Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Having a baby can be expensive. Diapers, formula, child care, and of course, medical debt. Noam Levy has the story of one Illinois family and the medical bills that piled up after their daughter was born.
Heather Crivellari and her husband made a lot of preparations before having their first child. They saved carefully. They got good health insurance. They looked for a community where two public school teachers could afford a home. But when Crivellari and her newborn daughter Rita came home from the hospital, there were still mountains of bills to navigate.
It really felt like a full-time job some days, getting the baby down to sleep and then getting on the phone. I'd set up one payment plan and then a new bill would come that afternoon.
Altogether, Crivellari and her husband were left about $5,000 in debt. That forced them onto 9 payment plans to keep ahead of collectors.
And we had a healthy baby. I just kept thinking, like, what am I going to do if she does get sick?
Crivellari's pregnancy had been a little more complicated than most. She developed high blood pressure, and Rita was delivered by emergency C-section. But the Crivellari's medical bills were hardly unusual. New parents in the U.S. with private health coverage on average face more than $3,000 in medical bills that aren't covered by their health plan. And if there are complications, bills can run more than $10,000.
Even though they have insurance, they still have these very high bills.
That's Dr. Michelle Moniz, an obstetrician from the University of Michigan. She studies out-of-pocket costs faced by new parents. 100 million people in the U.S. have healthcare debt. About 1 in 8 say at least some of it came from pregnancy or childbirth. That's according to a nationwide KFF poll. These people also have bigger debt and say they are more likely to make difficult sacrifices, like cutting back on food or clothing. Dr. Eileen Atwood is an obstetrician in Rhode Island.
You feel bad because you know that they want the best for their pregnancy.
Atwood routinely sees young parents anxious about debt.
They are having to make real choices, and what those choices may entail can include the choice to not get certain services or medications or what may be needed for the care of themselves and their fetus.
For the Crivellari family in Illinois, the worries over finances got real when Heather was diagnosed with the preeclampsia. It's potentially life-threatening. She was moved from her local hospital to a larger medical center 30 miles away.
I do remember thinking when they insisted that I ride in an ambulance, I'm never going to financially recover from this. But it's like, oh my gosh, I want my baby to be okay. I want to be okay.
A state senator in Massachusetts says parents shouldn't have this kind of worry. And
when women don't get adequate care during a pregnancy and postpartum, that costs the system an incredible amount of money.
State Senator Cindy Friedman is sponsoring legislation that would exempt all medical bills related to pregnancy and childbirth from copays, deductibles, and other cost sharing. Crivellari says she wishes new parents could catch their breath before they have to start paying off their medical bills, kind of like student debt.
When I graduated with my college degree, it was like, oh, hey, new adult. It's going to take you 6 months to kind of figure out your life, so we'll give you the 6-month grace period before your student loans kick in.
Crivellari and her husband did manage to pay off the bills from the pregnancy, but they sank back into debt when their daughter Rita, who is 2 now, needed surgery for ear infections. It's all made Crivellari think twice about going to the doctor, even for Rita. And she and her husband are now firmly resolved not to have more children. I'm Noam Levy in Jacksonville, Illinois.
The Schwann's Company has been delivering frozen food to households since 1952. The company's yellow trucks and friendly delivery people are especially beloved by their customers in the Midwest. But Schwann's Home Delivery has since changed its name to Yellow and cut staff in delivery centers. Elizabeth Rimbert explores the company's legacy and future.
Since 1965, Mary Bartles has been looking forward to her Schwann's deliveries. She remembers her 9 kids excited to see the delivery man drive his yellow truck down the driveway.
They would get on the truck and climb all over it, and they'd all come in with an ice cream bar or something. And now I realize he was giving those to those kids out of his pocket because I wasn't paying for them.
One of those kids actually happens to be my stepdad, which is how I know that nearly 60 years later, Mary is still ordering ice cream, frozen food, and meals from Schwann's. And on this Thursday morning in Vermilion, South Dakota, it's time for another delivery.
That's the manager now. Come in!
Nate O'Grady takes a seat at Mary's kitchen table. He's her delivery man now and says he has his own memories of Schwann's. As a child, he remembers the yellow trucks coming to his grandparents' house. And now he says he loves getting to know the customers along his route.
You know exactly what they want when you come to the door. You know exactly what they're going to order. Mary's going to get her peanut butter cups, I know that.
Mary says it's the great service that's kept her buying from Schwann's for nearly 60 years. She doesn't even have to get out of her chair as O'Grady checks her freezer for what she needs, grabs the order from his truck, and packs it onto the freezer shelves. Back in 2022, Schwann's changed its name to Yellow, spelled Y-E-L-L-O-H. Some customers, including Mary, didn't take much notice.
When did they do that?
The new name is inspired by the unmistakable trucks, according to Bernardo Santana, the company's CEO.
That's one of the reasons we kept the name as Yellow, because of the famous and recognizable yellow truck, to bring back and to keep this connection with our customers.
The makeover comes as Yellow contends with a much more competitive market. Danny Edsel, a co-leader for Deloitte's global grocery practice, says the food space has transformed since the company started in 1952.
You know, over the last 40, 50 years, we've gone through like several waves of evolution.
Local family-owned grocery stores gave way to big box stores like Walmart, Target, and Costco. And now it seems every company, dollar stores, gas stations, delivery apps on your phone, are fighting for your grocery dollars.
We're right in the heat of that battle. I think it's yet to be decided who wins.
Edsel says the companies who put their customers at the heart of their operations will probably come out on top. But Akshay Rao, a marketing professor at the University of Minnesota, is concerned Yellow's new strategy may confuse its devoted customers.
And so Schwan's had a monopoly that it is now said, to the best of my understanding, it has said goodbye to.
About a year and a half after announcing its new name, Yellow made another announcement. It cut 750 employees and closed 90 delivery centers. Its Yellow trucks used to make deliveries in all 48 lower states. Now it serves 18. Customers elsewhere can get orders via UPS. Rao suspects Yellow's new brand and the cuts are part of an overall strategy to modernize its delivery service.
The whole rebranding, cost-cutting through the reduction in their workforce and so forth is part of a strategic shift, which is emphasizing costs rather than customers.
Yellow CEO Santana says customers are still the priority, even as they become more efficient. Plus, he says, some customers prefer a quick drop-off rather than small talk with a driver. But for Deb Kuamoto, whose Lincoln, Nebraska address means she won't receive deliveries anymore, it's a loss. Ordering from Schwan's and seeing the Yellow trucks felt like stepping back into her childhood.
It's really kind of ironic because here, Schwan's, they were kind of like the first grocery delivery. And now everybody else has kind of caught up to them. I think it's the end of an era because I do miss the drivers. I really do.
She says she'll go to the grocery store instead of ordering via UPS, even if the store's ice cream isn't as good as Yellow's. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Elizabeth Rembert.
Illinois' largest known tree is a 200-year-old, 122-foot eastern cottonwood located in Mount Morris. Kim Johnson is with the Natural Land Institute. The group is recognizing it for its Tree of the Month. She says the size of the tree is not the only noticeable characteristic.
And it has a limb, a huge limb, that goes off the side of the tree, and I've seen children climbing on it. So it's a fun tree.
The Illinois Big Tree Register was established in 1962 to record and appreciate the largest native tree species in the Prairie State. And you can find it by going to go.illinois.edu/champion-trees. School districts provide a range of services to students with intellectual disabilities. Peter Medlin produced a series on what happens when those students become adults and have to transition into adult life.
In Illinois, students with disabilities can receive public school services through the end of the school year when they turn 22 years old. Jessica Marcellus Montavon is the director of the DeKalb School District's Transition Program. It's an extension of the high school special education program, and her students are between 18 to 22 years old and typically haven't received a high school diploma.
What we really start to focus on is vocational experiences and independence in daily living.
Marcellus Montavon says they prepare them to transition to adult life by working on life skills and spending time volunteering among several community partnerships. They garden at Walnut Grove Farm and do laundry and socialize cats at Tails Humane Society. They only have 6 students in the program this year, but expect 10 next year and 16 students the year after. And a lot of the transition program's efforts are to help students with intellectual disabilities and their families understand the web of services and agencies they'll need to work with after they leave the public school system. In fact, those conversations begin much earlier. In Illinois, the law requires all students with IEPs to have a transition plan in place by 14 and a half years old. Marcellus Montavon says it's when they start conversations about a student's future, college and career, and soon after, it's time to think about guardianship, savings accounts for people with disabilities known as ABLE accounts, and Medicaid.
Once they hit 18, most of our students can't access Medicaid, which is funds for the family at that point to help continue to support their young adult with the disability at that point. That's been a blessing for many families once they get through that. It's a very tedious process.
The other major task is getting the student onto the PUNS list. It's a state-run database of people with developmental disabilities who are seeking state funding to help pay for services. They could be looking for in-home support, placement in a residential setting, or support and employment.
Most families that would be cost prohibited to be able to pay out of pocket for those services.
This is where several issues come into play for the families of students with disabilities. One, you can't both receive state PUNS funding and continue in the public school system. And two, you can wait on the PUNS list for a long time before you're selected to receive funding. In 2023, most of the people who were approved had been on the PUNS wait list for a little over 4 years. That's actually an improvement from where it was. In 2019, most people had been waiting over 7 years. And since you can age out of the public school services at 22, it can be a big problem if by that time they haven't been approved for state funding. Right now, it means many young people with intellectual disabilities have essentially a gap year or two without adequate services. Kyle Gertis with the DeKalb School District says it's a tough system for families.
I think the hard part then is knowing that that same type of structure and support may not continue for very long after they're with us.
The main reason why the waitlist is shorter now than a few years ago is because of the LIGAS consent decree. It's federal oversight of Illinois' adult services delivery system. Kathy Carmody is the CEO of the Institute on Public Policy for People with Disabilities, which represents service providers. And she says, basically, the decree means the state agreed to provide access to adult services within 5 years. Carmody says the state has made strong strides over the past few years. Now, the state of Illinois has asked to end that consent decree despite being out of compliance since 2017. And she says there is a general sentiment among community agencies and families.
We feel that a lot of that has been done because of the federal court involvement, and we want to see that forward momentum continue.
But once adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities are approved for services, where do they go? College, the workforce, home? Well, once they leave K-12 education, many families need home, community, or residential services. And a staffing crisis there means that their time on long wait lists may be far from over.
In addition to our 7 classrooms, we also have a sensory room.
I'm touring Opportunity House's over 50,000 square foot facility in Sycamore. They're a service provider for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. They have day programs, supported employment, and recreation. They also have 10 group homes for residential care in DeKalb County, most of them staffed 24/7. They're closing an older home soon, but also opening up 2 new ones. Families of adults with disabilities spend years waiting to be approved for state funding to help pay for services like these, but it doesn't end there. If a parent can't provide quality care at home and they need residential care from a place like Opportunity House, they have to sit on another wait list. And Opportunity House's Janisha Harris says families usually have to wait a really long time.
We really rarely get openings, and maybe one every couple of years, but our wait list is about 7 to 8 years long right now.
Tom Mattia is the executive director of Opportunity House, and he says they could probably open 4 or 5 more group homes given the need, but it all comes down to staffing. And hiring has been a challenge for their new group home, too.
We will not open it until I have it fully staffed.
He says they have about 15 openings right now, which is half of what it was last year, but it's still too high. Staffing is their biggest issue, by far, and the reason is, in some ways, simple.
85% of my staff could go out and get paid more doing something else, but they don't because they believe in the mission.
The toughest positions to fill are direct support professionals, or DSPs, who work directly with people with disabilities. That's because agencies like Opportunity House, who contract with the state, can only use state funding to pay for those salaries. So the state essentially dictates the wages and if they get a raise.
On average, our DSPs, when you look at our starting wage, is like $16 an hour.
Supporting adults with disabilities can be really tough, so when you can make just as much or more at Starbucks, it's a difficult sell. This is not just an Illinois problem, though. Lydia Dawson is VP of Government Relations for Anchor, a national community of providers for people with disabilities, and they also help put out several reports about access to services.
The 2023 edition, we saw 95% of providers experiencing moderate to severe staffing shortages in the past year.
The vast majority had to turn away new referrals because of staffing shortages. It's a vicious cycle that leads to higher turnover rates for DSPs, which then impacts quality of care. Nationwide, the DSP turnover rate is around 50%. Mattia says it's a little bit better at Opportunity House, but he says they're continuing to advocate for pay increases for DSPs.
I think there was a stretch of six consecutive years where there were no increases given.
That changed during the Pritzker administration. There have been increases, but Mattia says it's hard when there's also a corresponding rise in the state minimum wage. He says they want direct support professionals to make at least 150% of minimum wage so they can compete in the job market, but they're not there yet, and the governor's proposed budget doesn't include an increase. Many other states have closed or downsized state-run institutions. In Illinois, investigations have uncovered abuse and neglect, but they haven't closed in favor of community-based groups like Opportunity House. In the meantime, waitlists for services aren't going anywhere. There are still thousands waiting for services in Illinois. Mattia says not a week goes by that they don't get requests from elsewhere in the state saying they've got someone who'd be a great fit for their group homes, but they just don't have room. And if someone local desperately needs a spot and they don't have the space, they could be shipped off away from family and friends. And he and other advocates hope continued state investment will improve the system for DSPs and, most importantly, the adults with disabilities they care for. I'm Peter Medlin.
Just ahead on Statewide, Peter Medlin will continue with his reporting, taking a look at the educational opportunities available to adults with disabilities after high school. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We continue now with Peter Medlin's series on services for adults with disabilities and what educational opportunities are available to them after high school.
Sarah Hind wants to be a professional disability advocate and motivational speaker after college. She has cerebral palsy and has already been doing advocacy work in person and on social media since she was 13. She's 20 now and a student at Rock Valley College in Rockford.
And now I'm actually doing speeches where I get to talk about my individual story as well as advocate for individuals with disabilities.
She's part of the RAISE and CTP programs at Rock Valley. RAISE is a transition program for students with intellectual or developmental disabilities coming out of high school. It's 1 year with four courses. They include a financial literacy class and a personal empowerment course to help students advocate for themselves and understand their rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Rachel Bogue is the RAISE program coordinator.
We have two goals for our students, and that's either continuing on taking more classes at RVC or entering into the workforce.
CTP, or the Comprehensive Transition and Post-Secondary Program, is a designation from the U.S. Department of Education. It allows students to receive federal financial aid even if they're not taking courses for credit. For students like Hind who want to keep taking classes, CTP also opens up the course catalog for them. Instead of being limited to a set number of courses, Bogue says students with disabilities can take almost anything they want. For example, Hind is taking a lot of English classes for her motivational speaking.
What makes it different with the CTP is extra support. So any student who's a part of that program, I work with them as their advisor. So I'm checking in with their instructors and making sure everything's going good. I'm checking in with the student and seeing what they need.
There are 28 students in the RAISE program and 6 in CTP. That might seem small, but Bogue says it's because they want to focus on supporting those students as much as they can. And not every region of the state has a similar post-secondary program. There are currently 16 colleges and universities in Illinois that offer programs for students with intellectual disabilities, 6 of which are in Cook County, and just half of the 16 programs have the CTP financial aid designation. And a lot of students with disabilities, like Hind, feel like they just don't have many options.
For me, it was either go through RAISE or you don't go to college kind of thing.
Bogue says often disabled students aren't invited to college visits. They send RAISE information to high schools, but there's no guarantee it'll get to the students, and parents might not always know their resources either. Bogue says RAISE currently partners with 6 local high school districts, and they're always looking for more. And she says a high school district from outside of their community college region recently reached out because their community college doesn't have a program. She says transportation is always a big obstacle for RAISE students, let alone if they're from outside of the area. Bogue thinks that every community college should have an inclusive program.
We exist to serve our whole community, whether that's credit, non-credit. And when we ignore people with intellectual disabilities, we're ignoring a huge portion of our community that we should be serving.
There are some other education options for folks with intellectual or developmental disabilities in Northern Illinois outside of the college setting. In Rockford, RAMP's Project Search is a work-based transition program, and Opportunity House has a Learning for Life curriculum, among others. Back at Rock Valley, Sarah Hines says the transition from high school to college can be really difficult for students with disabilities because you don't have an IEP or 504 plan anymore.
You don't have a full team of people that are willing to help. You're an adult, so you have to advocate for yourself. You have to know what you need.
She's been advocating for herself for a long time, along with her younger brother, who also has cerebral palsy. And it's her passion and goal to be the advocate her younger self needed. Hind is graduating from RAISE soon. In fact, she's giving the RAISE commencement speech. Hind plans to continue with the CTP program and take classes to help hone her motivational speaking and writing, and she hopes even more students with disabilities like her get access to college and the chance to reach their academic and personal ambitions. I'm Peter Medlin.
Well, it's the end of the school year, and for some teachers, the end of an era. We hear from some Bloomington Normal educators who are retiring. Joel Misakonis has been a teacher and coach since he began in 1990. Jennifer Bolton started her career in music education 32 years ago. In this audio postcard, they reflect on their service to their respective districts, what's changed, what stayed the same, why they loved it, and what they'll miss the most.
Jennifer Bolton. I have taught for 32 years, and I teach music, specifically band.
Joel Misakonis. I teach some computer classes when they need me. And then I teach art classes also.
So my father was a professor at Illinois State University. And when I said I was going to go into music education, well, what are you doing that for? No, let's find you something else. He said, no, you're not doing that. Oh, but I am doing that. No, you're not. Well, I did.
I think a lot of teachers are inspired by other teachers. And so I was inspired by a teacher I had in high school. And I was always good at making things and working with my hands. And I thought, you know, maybe I could be an art teacher. So I knew my senior year that I was going to be a teacher, probably an art teacher. It was all because of one or two teachers in high school.
When I started, we traveled around. So there were a team of teachers of us, and that's how I've taught at all the elementary schools. Like three of us would go to this school, teach for 50 minutes, get in our car, go somewhere else, teach 50 minutes, get in the car, go somewhere else. So that's how the whole thing started. Then it's evolved through the years to what it is now, where I'm in one building only, and the elementary schools are bussed into the junior high schools.
I started working at Bloomington High School in 1990, and I think we got a computer on our desk like maybe like 10 years later. It was something like that. It was crazy. Now, every kid has a computer, and they have one in their pocket. It was just kind of the Wild West back then, you know?
So when I was in college, and then you first get out of college, I had a network of friends, and we all would help each other out in our first jobs because nobody had money. We started off at smaller districts or smaller schools, and so we would say, hey, you're a woodwind. Can you come do my marching band camp? Hey, you're a percussionist. Can you come do my camp? So we would all pitch in, and we would do things for free. And then when I got my first job, you're doing the same thing, but now you're doing it daily. I'm like, oh, wow, I'm actually getting paid to do this. How cool is this? They're paying me to do what I love to do.
Eventually, we got to the point where we had computer labs. When those came into being, then they're like, we need some computer teachers. Do you think you can teach that? I'm like, absolutely, I can teach that. And so I taught a web design really early, and a little bit of like making databases and things like that, you know, and then eventually, you know, all the kids got computers. Mm-hmm. So I reworked my whole curriculum based on these computers, things that I could never do before. Now I could do. It's amazing. I love it. I mean, absolutely love the way technology has made teaching easier.
The way students learn and the commonalities that you draw to make it more accessible to them changes with the environment. And the way the environment was 32 years ago versus today is very, very different. So staying current with trends, staying current in today's world, and making those connections, that's what changes the most.
Someone was asking me today, do you think the kids have changed? Has it gotten worse? I don't know that it's gotten worse. I mean, you have those kids that are challenging, and I've always had those kids that are challenging. But I think it's different. And I think a lot of it is the difference between, I think it's the technology really that makes some of the difference.
Things that we used to take for granted, now we have to work for. Supplies, money, that kind of thing. Things that were provided before are not provided now. So you have to creatively figure out how you're going to make that happen. And you keep reinventing the wheel to keep the wheel going.
A lot of times the art teachers pay for the materials. You know, I'm still buying materials. And sometimes it's not because we don't have the budget. It's just that I need it like tomorrow, you know, and I can't get the money from the district to have it for tomorrow. And if it's a few dollars or, you know, even under $30 or $40 or $50, you know, I don't even turn it in for reimbursement. You just buy it and because you need it.
I have feared for my job every single year of my teaching career. Is it going to get cut? Is it going to be there? Are there going to be reductions? What's it going to look like this year? Every single year. It's never been a constant. Yes, I'm going to do this and I'm going to be able to do it the same.
I kind of wish that teachers had more professional respect. They're not really treated that well, honestly. Teachers have a lot of education. Most of them have their master's degree. Most people like me, I have master's plus 48 hours, which if you've gone through a university, you know 48 hours is a couple of years of school. So I wish that they had just a little bit more professional respect.
I think when August rolls around, because right now everything is same old, same old. Yep. Yes, I know I'm leaving, but I still don't feel it. I'm still doing everything as I normally would. I think August, when everybody goes back to school and I don't, I think that's going to be the hardest day. My plan is to hopefully leave town for that first day so it won't hit so hard and then come back afterwards. But we'll see if that happens.
I always got towards the end of summer and I felt like I needed a couple more weeks. And I'm like, I'm just not quite done. I need a little more time before school starts. Just a couple more weeks would be nice. And so that will be nice where I don't have to go back to school.
Joel Misakonis and Jennifer Bolton, Bloomington Normal area teachers. They're wrapping up their careers in the classroom. A year ago, the humanitarian crisis in Chicago was chaotic. Families were housed at police stations. They slept on the floor. They didn't have access to showers. And others camped outside. During this chaos, a new phase in the effort to help migrants emerged when thousands of residents formed a mutual aid network to respond to the needs of asylum seekers. Adriana Cardona Magigad spoke with some volunteers.
Patricia Buenrostro is a college professor. She understands the challenges that many migrants face when they're starting a new life in the United States. That's because her husband migrated from Mexico when he was a teenager. So when Buenrostro first spotted asylum seekers staying at a police station near the Austin neighborhood, she was moved and wanted to help.
Entonces yo vi un día, era un viernes, y decía es que ocupaban cobijas porque la gente estaba quedando afuera.
Buenrostro says she saw people who needed blankets. It was last April, still cold outside. She says she told her husband, let's go and give them something to sleep with.
Mejor que lo usen ellos que tenerlo aquí nada más guardado.
They ended up taking migrants to shower and housed some of them for a few months. Migrants have been coming to Chicago since 2020, but last year there was a shift.
April, oh my God, it was insane.
Jeannie Kim is a volunteer. She says the South Loop District Police Station near her home suddenly had 200 migrants arriving.
People were dumping out donations all the time. I mean, it's so much. Volunteers were buying food from different restaurants. People started to drop off garbage bags and bags of stuff. It was sheer chaos.
Volunteers communicated through WhatsApp chats and Facebook groups for each police district. They stayed in touch with city officials regarding daily headcounts, created Google spreadsheets to keep track of donations and migrants' needs. More than 20 unofficial groups became known as police station response teams.
They were in charge of their own police stations. This means organizing volunteers, coordinating meals, clothing, supplies. They functioned as their own organizations.
The city eventually stopped sending migrants to police stations and transitioned most people to shelters. But the efforts continued. Today, volunteers connect migrants to medical services, help with school enrollment. They've raised thousands of dollars and have coordinated support with local churches and nonprofits. They provide essential needs that many migrants don't always get in city-run shelters, including clothes, diapers, menstrual pads, shampoo.
One of us will go through and we'll make a little bag. So if it's a school-aged kid, we'll often try to put it in a backpack.
Eleanor Kane became a volunteer at a police station near Wrigley Field last fall.
I can put myself in their position of being not just a mom of little kids, but, you know, in this super difficult time, you know, they've arrived to this new and foreign place and they're trying to get their feet under them. I think about what drives a mom of a little kid to leave where she is and to undertake this really scary journey to get here.
Kane shows me one of the supply kits for a school-age boy that she's about to deliver to the American Islamic College, one of 17 city-run shelters.
Inside this backpack, he's got a change of clothes. You can see hat, scarf, and gloves.
Each bag is marked with a migrant's name.
You know, we try and match the age and the size, right, so that it's something that we think he'll want to wear to school.
The needs are always evolving. As asylum seekers prepare to get kicked out of shelters, they need to search for apartments, get furniture, and find jobs. And if there's another surge of migrants later this year, some volunteers say they worry about burnout. Others are ready for the challenge, but they also want to sit at the table when city officials are making decisions on how to respond to this humanitarian crisis, because these volunteers have become a fundamental safety net for newcomers. Adriana Cardona-Magigad, WBEC News.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. We'll return next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find all of our episodes. They're available where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.